meeting of Parliament, Wednesday the 19th of May, 2021. We continue with answers to your questions. We commence at question number 65. The questioner is the Honourable Alan Kinsey.
Can the government please provide the total growth debt out of the debt after application of the sinking fund to growth debt, passing rates and net debt figures for public debt for the following dates being the 1st of March 2021 and the 1st of April 2021?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Enterprise.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 66 to 72.
Question number 66, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the balance in the general sinking fund on the following dates, being the 1st of March 2021 and the 1st of April 2021?
Question number 67, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Can the government advise the £150 million loan from the Gibraltar International Bank was repaid in April 2021?
Question number 68, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Can the government provide a breakdown of gross debt borrowed as of the 30th of April 2021? Analyze between the banking issues and bank borrowing, naming the lender maturities and interest rates.
Question number 69, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Can the government provide analysis of all loans granted by the Improvement and Development Fund as at the 31st of March 2021, showing the borrower amount outstanding, purpose, repayment schedule, and interest charge?
Question number 70, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise why the Gibraltar National Mint Limited has borrowed £500,000 from the Gibraltar Savings Bank by way of the debentures issued?
Question number 71, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the level of reserve in the Gibraltar Savings Bank as of the 31st of March 2020? The 31st of March 2021.
Question number 72, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise when and where does it intend to commence the 150,000 square metre land reclamation project, which is at the heart of the post-budget national economic plan?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Enterprise.
Mr. Speaker, the gross debt in March was £647.7 million and in April £697.7 million. The aggregate debt in March was £635.6 million and in April £677.7 million. Cash reserves and net debt. In March, cash reserves £59.7 million and net debt £362.9 million. The April figures are stated in the debt estimate book provided to the honourable member. The balance of the general sinking fund on the requested date were 1st of April, 1st of March 2021, £12,119,734. April, £20,019,928. The £150 million loan from the Gibraltar International Bank was not repaid in April 2021. The gross debt borrowing as of the 1st of April was as follows: bank, £325 million, debentures, £372.7 million. The amount outstanding of all loans granted by the Improvement and Development Fund as of the 31st of March 2021 is £65,843. The Gibraltar National Mint has borrowed this time
to invest in developing its business and provide income to the Gibraltar Savings Bank. The Gibraltar Savings Bank has prepared information requested in this meeting using the best estimate book provided to the Honourable Member. The government can provide the information when the reclamation projects are in a position to be proceeded with, which remains to be identified.
I beg your indulgence before I analyze what the Honourable Minister has said. If I can take the Minister back to his answer as to the cash and net debt on the 4th of March 2020, I may have misheard him. Did he give a number of net debt of about 360 something? The math didn't quite work in my head. I'm sure you'll appreciate that we have that. I'll give an aggregate debt to 422.6, which is impossible. If it is a gross debt to 450, I think the number should be on that debt somewhere like 525.9. Again, just sticking to the first step, next step question, which was question 155. Can Mr. Ben confirm that gross debt, in fact, has risen from the 1st of February 2021 to the 1st of April 2021 by the amount of £75 million?
I haven't calculated the figure myself, but I just calculated the figure. I'm going to Mr. Speaker.
Would you then agree with me, Mr. Speaker, that £297.7 million gross debt, that is, that's on salary, the highest debt level that we have reported in this house?
Given the fact that the Honourable Member supported that we would borrow $500 million, it's a figure that will continue to be growing until the $500 million is all borrowed. So I agree that it's higher than it's been before, and I predict that it will be higher still because we all agreed in this house to borrow $500 million.
If I may, before I move on to my next question, what we agreed was what the level of borrowing headroom was, not that we should borrow £500 million. I think it was an important difference in interpretation. But anyway, I'll leave it at that. Can I ask Mr. Speaker why the loan of 150 million from the Gibraltar International Bank was not repaid and they got rolled over.
What I am advised by the testimony is that there is, as a result of the COVID, there is a lot of cash in the International Bank and in many other banks. And that since this is a revolving loan that we've got, which has got a year still to go, repaying that loan and then lending them to somebody else would have resulted in the Gibraltar National Bank having to have an increase in share capital, which we would have had to fund. And the logic of not repairing it and figuring that situation was one that was discussed with the regulator, and it was considered to be in the best interest both of the International Bank and the government to continue to leave that amount unpaid at present, and it's probably the case that once the expected spending materializes of people coming out of COVID and being able to live more normal life, we may see that that situation will no longer be there. But of course, that expectation which many governments have in many parts of the world may not materialize. I mean, people may not go back on spending pre-hospital service, in which case at some point in time, we will no longer have to pay that money and increase the share capital of the bank.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful to Mr. for his answer. I have two questions. You may tell us, the Speaker, that he doesn't have information, or you may, the Speaker, describe that it's far too fundamental to the original question that the Minister has brought up the matter of the bank and the capital is important. And as ever told, I always ask two questions. One is, in terms of the risk-weighted assets of the bank, is it that a lending to the government of Gibraltar seems to be zero risk weighted? And secondly, is there any kind of indication of how much additional share capital would have been needed by the bank if the loan hadn't been rolled over?
The first question is yes, that is the case. And the second one, I believe the figure would have been something of the order of 5 million.
In respect of question 68, I've given 325 and 322.5. I assume 325 was bank borrowing and 375 debentures. But if the Minister reads the question, you will see that I did actually ask for some detail.
Well, they haven't given the interest. I think it's probably been given before, but I'll get it again and provide it to them, because the only thing that is new there is the 500, the 250 that have been drawn down already from the 500 million. I mean, no interest on that. But I will get it here. I agree with him that I haven't put it in the answer. But it will not be new information.
I'm grateful to me. Personally, in the 65, and you may have this information to hand. If we assume the 150 is the Gibraltar International Bank, are we safe in assuming that a difference of 175 is with RBS International Network?
My knowledge, there is no bank lending to the government.
Moving to question 69, and the minister gave me one number, 600 and something, I don't know if I have time to calculate it, because I write it all down.
they could repeat the number and could indicate who they are granted to. Although, again, I would ask for a lot more detail in my question. Mr. Speaker, it's £65,843. And the outstanding figure, these sums go back quite a long time. The one of them is India's Management Limited, the other one is the Bolton Tax Association. The first one is being repaid in 128 monthly installments, of which 13 are still remaining. And the second one is being paid in 120 installments, of which 15 remain monthly.
I wonder if the Minister would be willing to provide a schedule if I would ask you to understand the numbers and the borrowers. If you'd be willing to do that, it would be great for you.
That's what I'm going to get in a copy on my phone.
The Minister gave something like investment in development of the Gibraltar National Limb Limited. Can the Minister advise what kind of development we're talking about, and given that the entity has been in existence for a while, why has it now found a need for £500,000?
The Gibraltar National Limb is a business, right? It's a business that is expanding, and therefore it invests. I mean, £500,000 is not a great deal of money, given that the company, I think, has got a much bigger shareholding base, which is the first thing. Carol and Issy More Equity decided to borrow money to the savings bank and pay interest to the savings bank, and the turnover is increasing. We are performing very well, profitably. And the people that we have a partner in the sense that they are the ones who effectively do all our marketing. And in reality, they guide us in terms of the issues. I mean, I think if we do 20 different coins a year, one or two are determined by us and may or may not be successful. And the other 18 are determined by the people who are doing the selling and the marketing. And we are involved in assisting in that. But they are the ones that guarantee us a minimum figure for sales, for example. And therefore, rather than increase the equity, which is already quite a big equity base, we decided to borrow money, and that would mean some interest coming into the savings bank, where, as you know, the minority with the low rate of interest, it's difficult to find things into which we can invest.
Because the Honourable Minister knows, I'm going to see the results of the National Mint, which we have said. But if it is an expansion of sorts, I mean, can you give us an indication on what it is that's new, that the business requires £500,000, and if it's doing so well, why do you need £500,000?
The last thing I would want is that the Honourable Member opposite to die, because I'm very fond of him. So at the risk that there is of him dying, I'm afraid that I'm not prepared to be answering questions in the business of the business, because as far as I'm concerned, we're an investor. Look, the savings bank invests in a whole lot of companies that are local companies where we lend them money, and that doesn't lead to me having to explain why I lend. Invested more in £500,000 from any one of those companies. I mean, I can confirm to the Honourable Member that the return on that £500,000, which is better than we can get anywhere else, will be well worth having lending to them as opposed to lending it to somebody else. And that's from the perspective of the savings bank. In terms of the operations of the company, when the account finalized and published, we will be able to see them quicker than we would have done under the previous administration. And I hope there will be sufficient information there to remove the risk of that.
As a speaker, I can guarantee that I will not offend. Would the minister be kind enough to agree to publish the full account and not abbreviate the account?
I can only agree to one thing, and that is to comply with the law and publish what is required, the same as any of our competitors.
Can I just ask on this? I can't recall exactly the members explanation last time when we were discussing the national amendment. Am I right in thinking that the purpose of the company now is to in effect take over the industry of commemorative coinage, and that's the business that we're thinking about? Is that the business?
I don't think necessarily commemorative coins. You know, there are some things that are not coins that are sold in the market of coin collectors, but principally it is legal tender coins that we make.
And this being a company that, as I understand, is owned by the savings bank, one of the members and the minister with responsibility for the savings bank, does not agree that in those circumstances, and while of course we understand that the government has to make an adjustment, and so the savings bank has to whether it makes sense to lend to a company so that it pursues the business case, and maybe that or obviously the government has made an adjustment thinking that there is a case for doing this because it's going to generate profit. But in those circumstances, the minister not think he can or should account to the house in a bit more detail as to the business case for it.
The house is not being asked to provide any funding for anything here. This is not the money that is being used by the government from government revenues. This is the reinvestment of the positive money. I know that the honorable members believe that the best way to do, which is what they used to do, is to keep it in cash, either and reduce it, and that is what they did when they were there. Which meant in effect that they were spending a lot of money in paying interest rates without getting a return. But we don't have that philosophy. Look, the savings bank actually owns a share in Big Telecom. So if the savings bank thinks that Big Telecom is a good investment and it doesn't, then the theory is that because we are investing the money in the savings bank, we should then have to give explanation about the performance of the telecom. Why do they need extra money? What are they going to use it for? What is it do they buy? What do they sell? However, if instead of the money being put in the telecom, the decision is taken in looking at where we want to invest. That we want to invest in BT in the UK, which is another telco doing the same thing as the one here, then that one, we don't want to give any explanations. Well, look, the answer is that the savings bank borrows money from the public and reinvests it for the purpose of generating a profit which I wish could be higher, and it's not higher because we have got less money invested in profitable things like this and more still in the bank waiting for a profitable opportunity. That money, when it materializes, it simply kept there for the rainy day bank, which is not very as far as I would like it to be, precisely because we are not doing more of this. So the answer is that I do not accept that because we invest in a company that is in Gibraltar or in a company that we own, we have to give more information than if we invest in a company that is owned by somebody else or if we are a partner or we invest. But when they have the government companies, not only didn't they ever give any explanation, But they were made in the town. And it was very hard at that time. And in the previous history of Gibraltar, from the beginning of the first company under the early Israel, the position that we've been the government in a company, either because they want to do something through a state-owned company or on the private sector, or because they're looking for profitable opportunities that they could have taken investment and bring in everything. That doesn't mean that we manage the company in this parliament. We don't.
That will be the last question.
But doesn't it accept that there's a distinction? I mean, this is a use of depositors' money. So, the use of depositors' money, the accounted to the depositors, people who are listening, who are asking legitimate questions, is the nature of the savings plan, the savings plan is taking a decision. And what we're saying is, they need to account as national names necessary, but and with the guise of savings plans, with your responsibility, you know, you're using depositors' money, and you need to keep it in cash. You're using the depositors' money, and what basis is it being used? And it's a perfect need for just a question, too.
Who are those people that the honorable member can accept? But I can tell the honorable member, look, nobody forces anybody to invest money in their savings bank. There's plenty of other options. And there is not one month that goes by without the number of depositors and the number of depositors going up. So that doesn't suggest to me that there is any concern that there is no benefit for merchant on their book. Because if I were in my savings, I wouldn't put it in an institution where I was worried that I don't know what they're doing with my money. I don't think that it's true. It may be true that people who support him think that. I suggest that the people who support him, that I support him, and that's why he knows about it, that I don't. They're putting money in the savings bank. We're not about something like 1.5 billion. We don't need the money of those who don't believe we're doing the right thing.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Let's move on to question 21, which I think what we're about to refer to the savings bank. I appreciate that they are in the draft document, so they are draft, but I will not pursue the number further, as we will be debating it, no doubt, in due course. But it's good that you. I was just asking, and you talked about keeping reserves there as a rainy day fund. I mean, does it not consider now the time to take a dividend from the savings bank into the consolidated fund? Is not now a rainy day?
Peter?
But, I mean, I assume this question is not rhetorical. Because if I'm not doing something, I'm not me. Don't I think I should be doing it? If the answer was yes, I think I should be doing it, then I would be doing it, and then you wouldn't be asking me why I'm not doing it. So, you know, I don't know what the point is that it's going to make. Clearly, it's bringing less than it should be, thanks to the success of my honorable colleague, the Chief Minister, that was able to persuade the Malaysian government to provide a guarantee for a loan, which is at a rate of interest that the savings bank would not like to be lending at. So the position is, it's better that we make use of that money, and if at the end of the day there is no other, it's 10 or 4, then we can always fall back on this. That is the more sensible thing to do. Still, we're actually mentioning on a number in the chapter of everything we're doing, but does he not consider it's somewhat ludicrous for the government to be borrowing money from the savings bank when it could even just obtain a dividend from the savings bank? Why pay the savings bank 3% interest when you just simply get the money itself? It's a ridiculous round stripping of interest payment. They don't pay interest, they don't have to pay. It makes no sense. And the speaker, if this is a rainy day fund, if this is really a rainy day fund, where it should be used.
Speaker, I can't accept that the honorable member belongs to a party that
for 15 years didn't have a rainy day fund, and that in the first meeting of the first parliament, Michael Assembly was brought in. After the election of 1992, the first thing they did was say, the rainy day is today, right? And they emptied all the penny banks and used all the money. And they only became converted to the rainy day fund in the last couple of years. So they're not going to be lectures on how to do it because for 15 years they probably should not be done at all. So the answer is look, even if that were the case, the money that we are paying is not money that we are giving away, it's money that is contributing to the profitability of the bank and creating the good in the future. But look, if and when it gets into government, we can either go back to the old system and stop using the savings bank, run it down to the ground, keep it just with the ordinary account and cash, and never bring the day fund and do all the things that we did before. What we are doing is what I believe to be in the best interest of the government and the voter, which is what I'm elected to do.
Mr. Speaker, now that I ask the Minister, under what circumstances would he use the reserves in the savings bank? Because it would appear to me, Mr. Speaker, that he has no intention of using them at all, for whatever political reason that he thinks links to manifesto, that it is somehow a virtue to have his money parked under the guise of the savings bank, where he uses money from the government to devote it anyway. It is ludicrous. It's a false economy to be borrowing when he has the money at his disposal. It doesn't make any sense.
Because I read him and well demonstrated that in fact his mindset is exactly the same as the 15 years, so he can no longer argue that what happened in the 15 years was wrong. He has what is absolutely to do is precisely to bring the result of a savings bank down to £1,445 and for the first time, which is what I inherited from his party when they were in government. And clearly, I think that they were doing that. I criticized them when they do it, and we've got a different policy. Doesn't he understand that the policy that the electorate want to see in place is the one that we are using to the what they voted for, and they've been voting for right now since 2012 in the knowledge that that's what they're doing, it's not a secret, and that the policy that we want me to adopt is the one that I criticize. Well, look, I don't do that. I don't criticize things from the opposition and then do them in government. If I criticize them for running the reserve down, why should I now do what they were doing, which I did not do when it was in opposition? When I was in opposition, I was able to go wrong to do what he wants me to do. And I'm now doing the opposite. If he believes it, what his predecessors believe, he can come and do that, which is precisely what this. We don't have any reserves, we don't need any reserves in the savings bank, and we spend them. And then there will be no money in the bank. I mean, why is it so keen to see that reserves is a failure? So that we can say to the electorate that we spend and we have another home in the bank, is that what it's after?
You can ask supplementary on question, the answer to question 72.
Peter, turn up the number 72 as you suggest. Can the Minister advise, in terms of the 150,000 square metre land reclamation, where will the site meant to be? And in terms of a time frame, given that the Wellington just recently put out a tender for the removal of a fraction of the rubble mound from the east side, I mean, don't we envision it to just happen within the lifetime of the Parliament?
Thank you.
But I'm here to provide information, not to engage in speculation. And the information that I provided is clearly that at this point in time, we are not able to give him information as to when it's going to happen or how long it's going to take. There are things that prevent us proceeding with this project at the moment. And when we are able to move and we have information, we can't provide it. And until we do, we have to wait, let them wait.
Madam Chair, can you indicate where this project is going to be started? And what extent is this company who thinks that the National Economic Plan?
I don't propose to give any information basically. No.
The Honourable Member said a question ago that he's here to provide information. I think now, but I understood his position now is that he's not here to provide that information on that specific question.
I have told the Honourable Member that the information will be provided when the information is proceeded to that, not, and I will not provide the information now. It's quite apart from anything else, the exact size and place of the information can change at any time between whatever I say today and whatever happens when we are ready to proceed with it. So the answer is, I will not provide the information because that is not information that I can guarantee would be what will take place. Everything at the moment is, in fact, waiting for developments that will enable us to proceed with the things that we need to do.
Speaker, this will be the final meeting. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member has said the size of the limit might vary, but so let me put the question this way. In this manifesto, very specifically, it refers to 150,000 meters, very specifically. So is it, and this, the land reclamation of 150,000 meters was a central plank to the post-Brexit economic plan. How is it that the post-Brexit economic plan can take off without this central plank?
Well, first of all, let me say, Mr. Speaker, that I welcome that the leader of the opposition is keen to see the post-Brexit economic plan take off. This is a good thing for us. Yeah. I welcome his effort for that. Of course, there is no way you have to run either on that one, so it's either that or nothing, because I didn't have one. But I think the fact that it's the main problem, I'm talking about the adjustment, you know, he may think it's the main problem. There are things that were planned to have happened earlier, which have not happened. But the obvious reason that nothing has happened since the beginning of the pandemic in anything to do with construction and so forth. But I can tell you that in terms of delivering the plan and its benefit, the plan sets out a picture of what is going to contain. That picture is dependent on a number of factors that we encounter once we set out as a government to implement the policies that we defended in the election. I have told you all the members opposite that my target is still to achieve the levels of economic growth from the new base that we were aiming to do from the original base. And I can tell you that the thing that the projects that were designed to take place in the land that was designed to be created are all there still in the pipeline, and that there are indeed more things than are contained in the manifesto which we expect will materialize between now and the next election.
My next question.
We now move to question number 62. The questioner is the Honourable D. Jameson.
Thank
government has an intention in the medium to long term to fund the sector with dedicated financial services ombudsman.
The Honourable the Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Question number 63, the Honourable DJ Buckley.
What budget has the government dedicated to the financial services
office? I said the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, I remember when the government has set the appoint the Ombudsman of the Financial Services Ombudsman once the arrangements are in place to provide him with the appropriate expertise to enable him to carry out his specification. We are assisting in procuring several rates and credits at the firm who may be interested in providing this expertise to the financial service ombudsman as case handlers. Once we have this information available, we'll be able to more accurately estimate the cost of the value of things.
And so, if we begin to long-term plan policy about the ongoing of the answer, is this the government's plan? Is it just a sense I got, not on the basis of anything that said on the basis of the nations and related to the problem of the authority? Whether the sense I got is that this is almost like a stopgap measure, because we have the government and have a future plan to respond to especially dedicated financial services ombudsman. Does the government have a policy to continue with this arrangement, or is it his intention in the future to have a specially dedicated emphasis?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's a case of we believe this will work. We believe that the ombudsman will have the necessary expertise available to him to reach the appropriate judgment. But obviously, we took it under review, and if we feel that it's not working or that it could be improved, then of course we will review the review. And come back with an alternative. But at the same time, we think it will work. If the forum is comfortable that it can work, and therefore we need to see how we go in terms of whether we can arm him properly with the expertise available future funders to be able to reach the appropriate decisions at the appropriate time.
There's a lot of argument that will be determined also by as to when he expects that half full thing of the financial services back. Which is the one that's dedicated to the financial services ombudsman, will be commenced. I understand it hasn't yet been commenced, and he's nodding his head in agreement. Can you say when you expect that part to commence?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it hasn't been commenced. It hasn't been commenced. It's too loud. We have the infrastructure ready for him to work. So, the Tiffany's Finance Center is assisting him in engaging with all firms in Gibraltar. We may be from providing services, and once we have that ready, we're going to appoint him. We don't want to be receiving compared to having the ability to deal with him.
And do you envisage that you have a timeline as to when you expect to be passing, I think as the minister responsible on the relevant legislation, the particular regulation which will assist the FSA to conduct his duties as provided under the Act?
We expect that to be in the short term. So, I'd say a couple of months.
Thank you. Well,
with
this will be the final question for the Honourable General of the
Service. Do you have any ideas to how many financial services disputes the Ombudsman is likely to encounter? I know this may be an unfair question, but given his experience in doing the job now for 2013. Do you have any idea of anything as to what the likely workload is going to be? Assistance will require from outside his department.
My understanding is legislation covers complaints to the section of the date of commencement, and therefore I don't expect there to be the following claims being put forward. So I guess my response that would be, I guess, would be this.
We'll review the position.
Given the gamut of financial services areas, so it includes companies in France and so on and so forth, and other districts with a very specific funds in a very specific area. How are you going out to potentially interested parties on case handling, so for example,
business work on a case-by-case basis, and this is going to be an enormous amount of money on a case-by-case basis if they don't close out other complaints in the form that we go to sign up. Is it on a case-by-case? Is it going to wrap this process up for the ombudsman and the budget? Or is it going to be on a kind of sectoral tender? So, for example, you go out and use interested in providing case handling and insurance, then you put it out for some kind of mini tender or for the team those people interested in doing case handling and insurance. Or is it going to be, I go out to the sector, these are the people who are interested, and what I'm doing is I'm going to contract and kind of second them. I'm giving them a good research to be on the basis that is going to provide the lowest outcome to the taxpayer. So when the minister agrees, so we have to explore all those options to ensure that we get the best deal possible.
Yes, the speaker is all number those proposals are very cheap. Part of our endeavour will be to ensure that we deliver value for money to the taxpayer. I believe that what we need to do in the first instance is reach out to the firms, both legal and accounting, and others, possibly, who may be able to assist us with the more generic cases. I think there are primarily in banking, pension, insurance, which is obvious one. There are far more of them, but far less frequent in terms of complaints. So I think we need to tackle the main areas and then see how we go, because the deeper this system is, we may be able to bring them more if you need them, and if not, you don't use any of them. So it's a very fluid and open, and you know, the numbers will be saying, I need some help in a particular area which I haven't got cover for, we don't get it. Next question. Question number 54, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Kasanyan.
Can government give this house a breakdown of general costs, including licensing costs associated with its e-government platform, and can it specify how much has been awarded to date to companies like Dell and Deloitte?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Mr. Speaker, it is not possible to give a breakdown of general costs as requested by the Honourable Lady and subject all months related to delivery of services, as the entire government digital network, including the hardware, software, security, maintenance, licensing, all combine and contribute in different ways to delivering the service. The costs provided in the summary that I will be handing over are broken down year by year, as best as we've been able to in the time available, over the past 2 years, and include the significant costs incurred in accelerating, and also included costs incurred in exposing basic services across government with a resulting delay to the delivery of the mainland services project. These costs cover licensing and professional fees in respect of the following services: licensing and maintenance of government infrastructure, design and delivery of even services across government, ERP, new procurement, new purchasing. This also covers invoicing, where the previous payment voucher system has been discontinued and is now digital. This will also cater in the coming weeks for the delivery of HR expenses and payroll, a little behind. And through design and delivery of e-services across government result of COVID, we now have basic services and cleaning services. Both of the services have been used this past year, primarily in the DDLG and CSIRO departments, where some 20,000 applications have been processed, with fees paid in excess of £525,000 for these transactions. All of these services will be modified to fill these services as and when we are able. The employment service is now live and online, offering e-services with an announcement of expected shortly and the commencement of e-services at the Income Tax Office. As we move on from COVID, our focus returns to resolving issues on the administration as we continue to work through these and to the delivery of certain services on a gradual and rolling basis. Mr. Speaker, I must thank the team for digital services, ITID, Treasury, Ministry of Finance, and all those government departments, including the DHA, who have worked so hard and closely with us to get to where we are today and to bring e-services and new administration to within touching distance to our community. And I now hand over, Mr. Speaker, the appropriate question. Thank you.
I'd like to sum up what the counselor is from what I see. There's not a total sum, so I don't know if you want to allow me to talk it all up and come back and supplement you, because obviously I can't ask the question until I know the total. Thank you.
you will see those systems, for example, ITOD software developers, providing ITOD with software developers to help them in the work that they need to be doing. So, the answer would be no, I don't believe that we believe he's right, but if you ask me whether it's a journal worth having been on, absolutely yes. And as we started yesterday, the first thing that we were fully serving with employment, and the tax coming on in the coming months, I'm confident that we will see not just the efficiency, but the savings that we expect to get back from this technology.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Honourable Gentleman for his answer, but he tells me that he thinks I'm wrong, but at the same time he also tells me that he doesn't know how much it will cost. So I'd like to know if the Minister with responsibility for digital services should not be more aware of what this expenditure entails at the end of the day after giving me a sheet of 5 pages, so we understand or know what budget we're working on at the moment.
I'm not really quite sure where the lady is going with this. I've given her a detail of 5 feet of every single penny that has been spent. Is she trying to suggest that I don't know where the money has been spent on the week? I don't think she's answered that question very simply. Of course I do. I'm not quite given the information. If she can't translate that information into a question to ask, then so be it. But don't make suggestions that the government doesn't understand what's doing in this program when it has 5 or 6 or 7 pages. Of a detailed breakdown, which is what you're asked for, of every single cost and expense we've had in the delivery of our IT systems, digital services, design implementation, and everything else put together.
Mr. Speaker, I still don't understand how we're given 5 pages, but not a total. But in any case, we're talking about the general cost associated with the e-government platform. So those are the general costs I asked for. I'm not sure whether I'd like to ask the Minister whether any of these sums do not actually relate to the new project, but actually relate to constant costs with IT-related costs that have nothing to do with this new incentive and have all been functioning. So I was just asking specifically narrowly about the e-government platform and how much it costs, and whether we have actually got to a point where we're extended from merit the services that we actually have right now.
I will read the first paragraph of my answer again, but perhaps more clearly. It is not possible to give a breakdown of general costs, as requested by the Honourable Lady, in respect of all matters relating to delivery of e-services, as the entire government digital network, including all hardware, software, security, maintenance, and licensing, all combine and contribute to the delivery of e-services. In other words, e-services are not a new beast. We still have emails, we still have servers, we still have data centers. Overall costs and delivery of e-services are different component parts of it. The software, the licensing, these are all different parts of the delivery of the service. So what I try to do is give a full and complete list of every penny that we spend in the delivery of our traditional and the delivery of these services to combined in very long, detailed answers. Now, we don't get any one number or total, I'll do that next time.
I would two questions really for Minister. I would encourage the government to have places where the incentives, including their own. First of all, if you look at the first page, there are four footnotes, 1, 2, 3, and then there's all the way up to 5 elsewhere. Well, you know what they relate to. And that's why I noticed in there are line items that for some reason go up to zero in various places. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. And then I'm on my feet, Mr. Speaker, I just want to ask the third question is, are any costs relating to contracts that were discontinued in terms of implementation of the service, i.e. contracts that were terminated for failure to perform?
Speaking of the first part, the numbers will relate to the period of time of the contract, some of them explain, for example, on the first page you've got a whole load of different corners, because some of the firms in their licensing agreement with us require us to pay the local agent. And so we pay the license fee of that service to the local agent. And we try to put the information in, for example, the four from the bottom, five cloud service, that's a particular license, if you want it to be more, auto cloud license for £1,000. So some of these, we try to add as much to as we can to the answer, but the footnotes are different from the previous ones, which are different details which weren't requested. In respect of which of the contracts are no longer there, being terminated through failure to provide a service, I would have to get back to this 90% or 95%, and most of these contracts are not all of them actually managed by IT and Retail, which will come back to you. I don't have enough information to be able to answer that question.
Next question.
Question number 35. The Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Canada government confirm that it will enforce the illegal parking in George Harrisburg on Dennis Tower Road?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, we can confirm that the RDC and the Water Parking Management Services Limited are already actively enforcing illegal parking on Dennis Tower Road, and will continue to do so, as is the case with the rest of the industry.
I'm grateful for the answer and just one short further question. As the Minister knows, I get a number of complaints in relation to traffic, particularly those vehicles that park on that street at the supermarket. If you get a complaint from looking at complaints, I don't know, but as far as I'm concerned, I just have some new complaints about that particular street, which is constantly utilised by cars to drop off, collect, shopping outside of supermarkets. So I just bring it to their attention and wonder whether the police are absolutely aware of that particular area that I'm referring to.
On the basis that the information provided has been provided to the Royal Liverpool Police. Apart from that, on the basis that I'm sure that they're aware of where these people are going to be.
Next question.
Question number 36, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state when the government public anonymous survey of mental health services was completed and when it will publish the results?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Speaker, I will answer this question together with question number 37.
Question number 37, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can the government state if it will publish the roadmap to implementation arising from the publication of the mental health situation analysis report?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Speaker, the process relating to the survey has not yet been completed. Insofar as changes and improvements to the mental health services in the border, the government will be making appropriate announcements at the relevant time. This will include progress on matters arising from the mental health situation analysis report.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that answer, although it won't do much to allay the concerns, of course, of many of the charitable organisations that work in this area that have recently, of course, made public statements about the failing in the delivery of this particular care. But I would also ask the Honourable Lady this question. Back in November 2020, she said in relation to the report that she was pleased to publish the report, albeit 18 months late, with the sampling of death, Mr. Speaker, with a very clear plan and a vision as to how to bring together our states in a joined up way that addresses the needs of the community. She also said in the same public announcement, a great deal of work already undertaken since the report my emphasis received. There is a great deal of work had already gone into this during the 18 month delay that the government had in publishing this report. So therefore, the suggestion or the answer to my question that is not yet completed suggests that not a lot of work has gone into it. And I think that many people in our country would be very surprised, particularly mental welfare society and other charities doing mental health, that the government is doing 2 years on, is doing very little to help those most vulnerable in our community. Do you agree with that analysis?
The speaker knows, and if the speaker is the only person who has to listen to understand, then he would have heard the answer to that question properly. In that, Mr. Speaker, I think it's very clear from my answer that when the progress is reported, it's in fact wider than what we found in the situation analysis report, which, Mr. Speaker, I'm confident. Once public announcements in the progress are made, I think that people will be very pleased on the marked improvement.
Mr. Speaker, I take it from that answer that the situation on life support, as you all know, revealed very significant shortcomings in relation to the delivery of mental health care in our community. So that's a significant damning report, in my view. I think we've debated this before on television together. But what we're saying now is that as a result of that report and the government's further investigation, that there has been a wider analysis, Mr. Speaker? What is he saying? Are the issues concerning mental health for this market worse than the report is revealed?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman certainly has an art for inventing and translating what I just said. He knows that we've had this conversation and we've had it in private and we've had it in public, that we have an action plan and an action matrix that relates to addressing the issues that are highlighted in the mental health situation analysis report. He also knows that in addition to that, I commissioned at the beginning of this year for someone from the UK to come in and spend 3 months in Gibraltar immersed in our mental health services and all the other public sector bodies, including third sector organisations, so that we could prepare a mental health strategy. So it really is a concept that the improvements going forward are not just those that are highlighted in the situation analysis report. It's more positive than that. It doesn't mean, I think, trying to insinuate, Mr. Speaker, that the situation is worse. We've looked at the situation and looked at the criticisms of that report made and have addressed those, but we've gone further. This is our strategy, which the Honourable Member and the Member of the Public is seeing that is public, will go wider. Because our strategy goes very heavily into well-being and early intervention and a lot of things that can be done before accessing the services of the speaker. So the Honourable Gentleman needs to learn what his things make.
This will be the final question. I've had two so far. So I'm only allowed two supplementary questions. Or I've had three questions. I've two questions asked on the order paper. How many do I have as a speaker in the system? Last time I'm asking the question, how many can I have? I'm grateful, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm still quite confused because the Honourable Lady talked with action plans and roadmaps in the same breath by making public statements about their availability, the fact that they've done all this work. And the mental health charities are doing fantastic work in our community and trying to respond to the mental health crisis in our community, Mr. Speaker. If you go into public information, that would help members of our community understand what the plan is, Mr. Speaker. So what we could be doing is helping those who are very concerned about mental health condition. So if they go publicly in our community that the government is failing, we could at least try to alleviate the concerns of many in our community who take mental health very seriously indeed, Mr. Speaker, and publish the action plan.
Okay.
the government takes mental health issues extremely seriously, and the relevant announcement will be made as soon as we can, because we have embarked on a massive project in relation to mental health to improve the services that we deliver, to improve our communication with the public, because we are almost at the end of that stage where we've been undertaking all this work, particularly since the beginning of this year, because we know a lot of work has already been undertaken in the last few years, and we will be in a position to make an announcement on these changes very, very soon, because I cannot accept what one of the gentlemen is saying. He's trying to insinuate that mental health is not important for our government. It is one of the most important tasks that we have embarked on, Mr. Speaker, and I'm not going to labour the point. I think that we all know what the mental health situation was in the Labour government, but I'm not going to go that far. I am going forward. I am looking forward because I am absolutely committed in improving the good services that we already have, Mr. Speaker. Our services have come a very long way from where we found them, but I am absolutely committed and I am absolutely determined to improve them even further.
Next question. Question number 38, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
It's not that I can state that it intends to work with companies offering the COVID-19 testing, offering COVID-19 testing to bring down the cost to the end user.
Honourable, the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Next question. Question number 39, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
speak, the Tamil government states what discussions the government has had with the British government in relation to the supply of booster Pfizer vaccines.
I to the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
I will answer this question together with question number 40.
Question number 40, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state how the government will roll out the Pfizer booster to citizens?
I to the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
So the government of Gibraltar works closely with Public Health England and on all aspects of the COVID-19 vaccination program. At this stage, no definitive decision has been made by Public Health England or the UK government on the research. As no decision has yet been made by the UK, no formal plans have been made. However, tentative planning is underway in Gibraltar, should a booster vaccine be required, and given that this will be undertaken by the same management team who delivered the vaccination program in Gibraltar, I have no doubt that it will be completely successful.
Question number 41, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, since asking the question, I believe the government accepted the problems that existed in relation to appointments, but I will ask it anyway so that we can ask another supplementary. Can the government state why, despite the Ministry of Health statement on the 19th of April 2021, one member of our community continues to experience significant problems in accessing face to face appointments?
I answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
If you can break into the Honourable Gentleman for asking a question, you will be answered. On demand, Mr. Speaker, the demand on services post COVID-19 has been extremely significant, particularly since the announcement of the underway of increased availability of face-to-face appointments. This demand, and a combination of other factors, such as reduced clinics, particularly number of bank holidays, following the announcement, and other reasons, explained, Mr. Speaker, in the first 354 of 2021 on the 6th of May, resulted in the public experiencing difficulties in the week following the announcement. However, after looking at what occurred that week, a meeting with management with systems is now being flexible, and in fact, enhanced through the introduction of more face-to-face appointments and the availability of risk advantages.
Mr. Speaker, I think one of the points that was made in the exchange of the population outside this place was in relation to the use of digital technology to make the process easier. So I think that actually the question of face-to-face appointments has been a very significant issue, I think, for a long time, but as long as I've been in the health service as a speaker. And I wonder whether the Minister has had discussions with the Honourable Minister Eastman in relation to how we can deploy technology to improve the system. It's one of the issues that comes to me from constituents is, well, surely this must be an easier process. And I know the Honourable Member of Parliament for Biomedical Services has discussed this before, digital services and biomedical services. Mr. Speaker has talked about that before in this House, but I wonder whether there have been advanced discussions between the Ministry and how to make that a lot easier so that we can create an easier process for patients and for them in our community.
The Honourable Minister Isola and I work incredibly closely when it comes to the digital improvements of the DHA. In fact, there have been some changes to the system already in the last week or so, and there are changes as planned, and that's something that we are programming and will be implemented in phases. And as and when these improvements are implemented, we will announce them accordingly so that the public understands
what these things are
and how they
look. Next question. Question number 42, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
In the Canada government state, the number of complaints received by the DHA and the government in relation to all aspects of healthcare and growth in the last 12 months.
I think the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, during the past 12 months, the Green Corps has received 62 formal complaints.
I appreciate that this was not included in the question, but unless the Minister has the information to hand, there's been no in terms of categorisation what those complaints concerned. There could be medical malpractice, there could be harmless given medical assistance. For instance, for example, if you don't have the information, it's fine, I'll ask it the next time round, but it would be very helpful if you could include it.
That I don't have the exact detail. The details that I have is break down the department against which the complaint has been raised, for example, in the new and waiting time, and in relation, it's the information that I have is the number of complaints against the department, but it doesn't tell me what the complaint is. But it's a discussion that I'm happy to have with the honourable gentleman, and it may be that it's more appropriate to have this discussion behind the speaker's chair when I have the information.
I'm grateful for that answer, and I certainly will make her up on the offer. But there's just one aspect of the question which I missed before I clarified, and that was if there are complaints by the GHA, I believe that is correct, but not by the government, so I think that's the call for the government. Is the government receiving stuff from the GHA?
Okay, the GHA has a complaint procedure, and if someone outside of the GHA were to receive a complaint, then the complaint would be referred to the GHA complaint procedure, so it would be encapsulated in this.
Next question. Question number 43, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm the names of the ultimate beneficiaries of the company AC Limited, which is registered will be providing MRI services to the Water Health Authority?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman's information is wrong. Neither the government nor the GHA have entered into any contractual arrangements with any company for the local provision of MRI services.
Mr. Speaker, my understanding from notices that have been displayed at the GHA premises, which have been shown to me, relate to permission to buy a company by the name of AC Limited, a company that I cannot discover on companies' website. You know, the government encourages me to do that every time a company comes up to have a look at the registry that exists. AC Limited, in the form that I give in this question, doesn't exist. AC Limited is a company that was reflected on the formal notices on the building, particularly in Europort, for instance, and it refers to the provision of MRI services. So, can the government confirm what the current position is in so far as MRI services at the Gibraltar Health Authority?
Well, no, Mr. Speaker, this is whereas I'm showing that there is an application, a planning application, this is not in the interest of benefits, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, the government has had a history in relation to the MRI issue. The first time that the government brought this issue to the House, I believe it was the then the previous Minister of Alban for Health in relation to bringing, I think the phrase was bringing MRI home. The government then changed its policy and then sent out a tender effectively and asked companies to conduct proposals in relation to the provision of MRI services to Gibraltar. What we find now is that on particular buildings that may not be within the GHA precinct, but not within the GHA hundred, and I'm just trying to summarise the benefit of the answer on the question, Mr. Speaker. But if the building in question, which I believe is in Europe, what complex my understanding, this company has applied for permission for the use of MRI services to Gibraltar. Are those services also going to be supplied to the government?
Mr. Speaker, a private company has made an application. All the companies and private businesses are entitled to make whatever applications they wish. This application Commission is not on vehicle benefits, Mr. Speaker. They are, in your book, Mr. Speaker, is a very long footprint in an area in Gibraltar where lots of businesses operate. This occupation in particular is not on vehicle benefits, Mr. Speaker. I understand that its application has been made and displayed on Atlantic Street. I know what the other gentleman knows. I know that there is a notice of a planning application in Atlantic Sea. Atlantic Sea does not belong to the GHA. The GHA does not have anything in Atlantic Sea. And I'd be grateful to the Speaker, the honourable gentleman would not fireplay what I say erroneously and incorrectly. Mr. Speaker, a business has made an application. As far as I'm concerned, the Minister of the Health, it's not an application that I have had any involvement with, nor has the GHA had any involvement with. But a business is entitled to make an application for a business and then the specific amount of the business, but it's not out the question wholly anything connected with the GHA.
Just one further question, Mr. Speaker. It appears that AC Limited is not a company that is incorporated within Gibraltar. AC Limited is a company, as you rightly say, has a development notice, it's a company. As Atlantic Street, the question I would like to answer is whether AC Limited, apparently a company not incorporated in Gibraltar, has it ever been in discussions with AC Limited or intending to enter into contractual arrangements with AC Limited for the provision of MRI services to Gibraltar Health Authority?
Mr. Speaker, no. But he also said something about the notice being displayed with the provision of the minister. Mr. Speaker, no, the bank agrees with the GHA.
I wish to clarify, yes, because the very, very simple question is the government in discussions with AC Limited for the provision of MRI services to the GHA, or will it? Or if it doesn't have a contractual relationship with AC Limited for the provision of MRI services?
Mr. Speaker, again, no. To the second point, no. This is again, in fact, I have no idea what AC Limited has.
Next question. Question number 44, the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Mr. Speaker, can the government state from the cases investigated by the head of clinical governance at the GHA, Professor Derek Burke, in the last 2 years, the number of those cases who have suffered preventable harm or death is unduly high? I'll give you all the Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I'll answer this question today in question 45 of the debate.
Question number 45, the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Can the government state whether it is aware of an email issued by Professor Burke to his GHA colleagues in November 2020, where he claims that the GHA has been, and I quote, been effectively taken over by a cabal of about a dozen individuals and their followers. These individuals have paralysed the management structure and prevented a number of safety and quality initiatives from being completed. They are directly or indirectly the root of many of the preventable harm and deaths we have investigated in the past 2 years.
Question number 46, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state whether it is also aware from an email issued by the head of government, Professor Burke, to the GHA colleagues, in November 2020, in which he claims, I am clear from observation, from the experiences and concerns you have shared with me, and from my personal experiences, that the main weapons of these individuals are intimidation, coercion, and bullying of staff into their submission to comply with their views.
I am the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, Professor Burke's role is to investigate any concern where it is thought that clinical standards may not have been met. However, every clinical case varies, and it would be impossible to compare any level of clinical concern or harm to any other country or jurisdiction. And in relation to the question 45, I would say, yes, Mr. Speaker, the GHA is a very good
this particular email that was sent by the head of government to his UK colleagues is an extremely serious set of allegations concerning a cabal, as being described, a cohort of individuals within the GHA, which has very serious allegations and consequences, I see, Mr. Speaker, for members within the GHA, in fact, until the unions are involved. Mr. Speaker, but when did the government first become aware of these concerns? Because we're not talking about simple concerns about mismanagement here. What we're talking about are very serious concerns that have been directly or directly impacted on the health of members of our community, and indeed the word preventable death is being used in the context of these concerns, Mr. Speaker. So I just wondered, first of all, when the government first put on notice of these extremely serious and the allegations, when I first saw it, I couldn't believe, I must say, I'm quite shocked by it. So I'm just wondering when the government first put on notice of it.
I have in during my time in the system met with the clinical standards compliance director of the hospital in relation to issues that he raised. And on each matter, the hospital provides reports, and these reports are in the process of being investigated because individual circumstances have. There is a process, there is an investigation, there is an outcome. These matters are something that we are engaging in. And if I let you remember the reason why we introduced clinical standards, then it was to make sure that we improve the safety standards of the healthcare that we provide in the region.
I'm grateful for the answer. These are very serious allegations of bullying, intimidation, coercion, mismanagement of the GHA, which has, let's not beat around the bush here, this has led to the deaths of individuals within our community. What is the government, doing about it, Mr. Speaker? Mr. Speaker, the local government has answered something, which is, so serious that it requires to be addressed directly. The Honourable Gentleman said that the allegations in respect of bullying and sexual abuse has resulted have led to the death of individuals in our community. As far as the government is aware, there is not the slightest shred of evidence of that scandalous and frankly frivolously made allegation. Our understanding is that it is all part of the same year, and the question actually, question 45 says, as a direct quote from the email of the head of clinical governance, they are directly some of the deficiencies, or indirectly the root of many of the preventable harm and death we have investigated in the past few years. If an allegation has been made, has been made by my honorable friend to my right, has been made by the head of clinical governance of the GHA, the question that we are asking, and the minister may perhaps be the judgment of that basis, but the question we are asking is, given that this was 6 or 7 months ago, what has the government done to investigate this particular set of issues? Because presumably this is not just another report from the clinical standards that might be about this or that or some particular department. This is very wide-ranging and serious issue that has been raised by the head of clinical governance. It has been raised by the person charged with reviewing clinical standards that are very serious. What has the government done since the speech of that to investigate it, firstly, and secondly, handed on so that, having investigated it, it's not true.
Yes,
already said that he has connected the individual in question to further seek to show for information that might relate to the allegations as they are sent out in that and other communications, in order to ensure that the government can say, as I have said with confidence here, that there is not one shred of evidence that there is anything behind those allegations. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I will tell the House next. When these allegations were first put to the government, they were put to me. And so I called Dr. Burke to address the whole cabinet within days of the allegation landed on my desk. So the whole cabinet understood that if there were anything which might suggest that there have been preventable death intervals, and immediately acted to deal with that issue. The whole cabinet was addressed by Dr. Burke. I asked Dr. Burke to give me and the cabinet not the names of those alleged to have been involved in bringing those deaths about, but the names of the persons who had deceased in those circumstances, so that the government could put to the coroner the names of those individuals and their deaths could be investigated. I have not yet been provided with any. After that meeting of Dr. Burke with the whole cabinet, was that after or before the letter of November 2020? And if so, can you give us a sort of general range of when that happened?
Before, but frankly, Mr. Speaker, in the past 24 months, time has become a little elastic, so I'm not confident in giving a date, but the cabinet minutes will show on what date it was.
Did it before, and when you wrote this letter, having written the letter, it requires really further investigation and discussions, and it just went on. So can the government say that not only has Professor Bethel Bourne sent the letter, but having sent the letter, what have they done about that?
I told you how. When Mr. Burke first made the allegations and brought them to the attention of the minister, he brought them to the attention of me, I believe, and the Minister of Health at the same time. I was put an immediate decision that Professor Burke would address the whole cabinet. He addressed the whole cabinet days later. He was asked to give us the names of the individuals whose death he said he had identified as being preventable and arising for the reasons set out. He has not yet provided any such names. My intention, which I think will be the intention that will garner the support of every right-thinking member of our community, is to then, given any name, report that name to the coroner for a full coronial investigation into an alleged preventable death in Gibraltar. The allegation did not elicit, when it was challenged, any response that could lead to such an investigation that might enable either a full coronial investigation or blame thereafter to be apportioned for preventable death, because preventable death is going to result in either negligence or crime being relevant. Similar allegations, if not identical allegations, have subsequently been made by Professor Burke in the subsequent letters, which have been challenged in the same way by the Honourable Ministers who have been in the Speaking of those letters and have elicited no further detail of the sort one would expect in order to be able to deal with such an allegation, which can lead to a loss of confidence in the health services if there is anything behind it, and indeed which would require a serious and coronial investigation, because there is no alternative in my view. If there is a preventable death reported to the government, to the health authority, or to any responsible person, that death must be investigated to the level of the health services, and it must also, if it was preventable, be investigated by a coroner. That remains the government position. We have not been given any such name.
Final question.
The Chief Minister is saying that it's not just one letter, it's in a series of letters of a similar nature from Professor Burke. Listing generically or specifically and instances, but the series of letters which have drawn the same conversation and same kind of response from the government and indeed from the head of clinical government. In those circumstances, and looking at the effect of months, if the government does Professor Burton retain the confidence of the government?
Still, the government doesn't engage in discussions about the confidence it has in any one of its employees or those with whom we have contract services. Dr. Burton is not here to deal with those issues. I'm happy to deal with the issues that the honourable members have raised in the way that I have dealt with them. Yes, I have already disclosed that there is more than one communication, but I think you would agree with me, Mr. Speaker, that the responsible thing to do, faced with such an allegation, where the lives of the Bulgarians are alleged to have been lost in a preventable way, is to immediately seek to investigate them. And when the allegations are put repeatedly, and the questions are put to find a little bit further information, we have a responsibility to continue to seek to elucidate that information which we expect to be high and successive ministers for health have been receiving this allegation and repeatedly in the speaker to be.
Why did you allow the video to speak to you then? Did you ever conclude your question?
You didn't get through.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll take that. Mr. Speaker, the one thing that hasn't been mentioned in this discussion over the letters is that previous to the email of November 2020, when the lead of clinical governance discussed with Nepal of a dozen individuals, there was actually a letter by 32 GPs in August 2020. Signaling their lack of confidence for the need of clinical governance. That is, from what I understand, all the GPs in primary care and a proportion of the ones in secondary care as well. So what we're looking at is that between the 3 months of the lack of confidence and the letter back from Dr. Burke about the doctors, I would like to ask government what actually happened, because the government takes this into account, the fact that there would have been a tension, a bad atmosphere, low morale between the doctors, perhaps leading to some sort of retaliation on behalf of the leader's clinical governance, and based on the lack of confidence, they showed against them. So what I would like to know is what action did the government take in those 3 months, and how is it that they can justify the leader's clinical governance still being in position, considering that he enjoys zero confidence from the staff, and this tension has built up where it's turned into some kind of game. Is that responsible to keep the individual in his role, Mr. Speaker?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I would say to the Honourable Lady that she needs to consider the opposite. If a person who is a professor appointed to be head of clinical governance says in writing to the government that there are preventable deaths, and the thing that the government does is get rid of him at that moment, I put it to him that he would have come to this house to say that the government had got rid of Professor Burke to silence him because he had made these allegations, and that morale was very badly affected because there are preventable deaths in the health authority, and issues have been raised by a visiting professor who is responsible for clinical governance, and the government has dismissed him when he made that allegation. But the Honourable Lady is absolutely right, because she's just supposed to keep things that are relevant here. There is serious concern in the professional body in the GHS, the GPs, the nurses, and some of the consultants, about some of the issues that have arisen in the context of how clinical governance has been dealt with. And there is serious concern expressed in the way that you have heard in this house today by the head of clinical governance, which has
directly and to other health professionals as well, because none of us here or there are clinical professionals, and some of the terminology can be used by any party to a clinical district if they are clinical people, to pull the wool over the eyes of those who are not clinical, whether they are legal or otherwise professional. And so, the people of the government have been responsible in doing is in ensuring that we hear what all sides are saying in this respect. But I end with the speaker my response to the Honourable Lady by reminding her that in the context of the serious allegations contained in the letter by Professor Burke, the meaning to the Freedom of Press of Health, and subsequently in the communications to the Honourable Lady, as far as in this government is concerned, this is not an issue that can be determined politically or professionally. This is only an issue that can be determined judicially or quasi-judicially. Because if there is a preventable death, it must be investigated coronially. And so, Mr. Speaker, we must be careful with trying to make this too political. We put a finger on the issue that the doctor, as you say, has also raised issues. The honourable members have raised the concerns of Dr. Burke, and I think everybody would agree that the only responsible way to act, this is not just a focus, this is important, this is a line to protect, allegedly lost in a preventable way, that has to be dealt with very carefully, very carefully, and pointing in the direction of a judicial coronial investigation and determination. And when we stop that, we haven't had the information necessary to proceed to that level. Now, it may be that we do get that information, in which case I've already told you on the radio what the course of action would be, unless it were agreed that there were an issue of negligence or an issue which is criminal, in which case it may be that the advance of the government receives a system. But this is the most serious and most important issue that we should be dealing with, the lives of the people that we represent and the lives of the people.
This will be the last question from the good lady.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Chief Minister for his answer because it goes some way to explain the puzzle of what's been going on in this research. But one thing that I don't believe he's answered is before the letter about the accusations about the cabal in November, what process did the government take between August and that letter in November, 3 months, what process did the government take to understand the documents and why they manifested a lack of confidence in such a general and such a global amount of doctors here against the legal clinical government? I'd like to know what happened in those 2 months and if that issue was dealt with too.
What was done as a result of all of the aspects of this group? We are going to be pointing to that. We have questions about another aspect. But there are many aspects to this, and considerable work is done, not least the lady meeting as representative of that medical body, and my meeting with those representatives also, and the industrial relations representatives, which are United Union, I think exclusively United Union, I don't think it's the other union. And there was a number of meetings in respect of the structure of clinical governance and matters relating to how clinical governance is to be done in the future in a way that is considered to be let me not talk about what it will be less, but it will be really what it will be more. And that will be more if done in a committee style so that there is confidence that there cannot be one person's view. Where there may have been issues between individuals in the past, that was then exposing individuals to be investigating in a clinical governance matter to having to be judged by somebody who they may feel is already predisposed against them. So, what is envisaged is a change in the structure of how clinical governance is done. And I should just in that respect, Mr. Speaker, inform the House that clinical governance was not something which was undertaken objectively in our health services before, something that was introduced by the government. We took the first step of introducing objective clinical governance, which is designed to find when there are problems, not simply to explain, but to find when there are problems so that health systems can learn from that. And we're now hopefully going to be able to take a further step
which is to develop civic governance from being just a small part of what we do to being present in everything that is done in our host services, and this is one of the important parts of the work that one of the ladies is doing with the unions and with the professional bodies in the field.
Honourable Edward Phillips, and this will be the final question.
Mr. Speaker, I must say, I find the answer by the Honourable Gentleman to be a weight in what he has said and the analysis that he has expressed. I agree with much of what he said so far. He's not political, it's not professional, it's quite as he does with quite judicial. I think as may remember, I'm involved in many of the colonial interests which deal specifically with the disease. How he came by his death rather than keeping civil and criminal liability at the purpose, as he alluded to, of a coroner's inquest. I wonder, Mr. Speaker, putting that all aside and given what he said about clinical governance, whether something that government should give serious thought to, given the allegations and the threat of both sides of this particular matter, whether given the systemic issues that are evident around clinical governance, whether the government might consider public inquiry into this particular subject. I say that now not to pressurize the government to make a decision, but given the significance and importance of this question to our community and public safety and health and safety, will the government consider that as a potential avenue? Mr. The Honourable Gentleman is about to call the preventable death by agreeing with Mr. Vehemently, seems to give me an unexpected stroke. But I appreciate that this is an important issue, and I think that you need to demonstrate the maturity of the choice by not being a party political on the issue of the future. Mr. Speaker, the government is already doing considerable work with the Ministry for Health, and I distinguish the Ministry for Health as well from the Health Authority, and the Health Authority, professionals in the Health Authority, and those who represent individuals in the health authority, that is to say, the union, to investigate how different areas of the GSA, which have been the subject of some of these allegations, are operating and how we can operate going forward. So, given that we may not have the data that we need to have our own investigations, we're certainly ensuring that we look at how we're doing things in particular areas and continue to learn from best practice. And that is what I call the recasting of health services and devoted to a pandemic, which is work that is ongoing with the union. And all of this dovetails together, Mr. Speaker, in order to ensure that the health services that we are offering our community are, of course, value for money, but also, as best as possible, inspired by best practice in the lead jurisdictions in offering. Be at the point of delivering healthcare, that is being done to people. Because it's not the only system, but it's the system in which we take most of the work. And the one of the ladies is doing considerable and, if it were not fair, Mr. Speaker, exhausting work in ensuring that this is something that is dealt with very quickly and is seen as difficult that a professional in whom the government and the professional body in the hospital have dealt with.
Next question. Question number 47, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Speaker, how many convictions have there been in the last few years in respect of any importation and due to supply of cocaine, cannabis, and heroin into the
country? Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
During the policing year 2018-2019, there were 3 convictions for the importation of cocaine and 3 for cannabis. In the same year, there were 3 convictions for the supply of cocaine and 2 for cannabis. In the policing year 2019-2020, there were 2 convictions for the importation of cocaine and 2 for cannabis. In the same year, there were 2 convictions for the supply of cannabis. In the policing year 2020-2021, there were 3 convictions for the importation of cannabis.
Next question. Question number 48, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
How many convictions have there been in the last past 3 years for crimes associated with the carrying or injuries caused by the carrying of knives, guns, or other offensive weapons in the bush. I move to the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
As you see, that in relation to the carrying of offensive weapons, the number of convictions during the last 3 years were 2018-19, 11, 2019-20, 14, 2020-21, 2. Convictions relating to injuries having been caused by offensive weapons during the same period were 2018-19, 3, 2019-21, 2020-21, 0.
In addition to the answers the lady has just provided, and thank you for the answer, just to have a breakdown as to whether those offensive weapons were knives, guns, or any other type of offensive weapons?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I did. For the policing year 2018-19, 6 related to knives, 1 related to a gun, and 4 related to another weapon. I'm sorry, I don't know what the other weapon is. And that, and in relation to the conviction, 2 related to knives and 1 related to another weapon. For the following year, Mr. Speaker, sorry, conviction of carrying a weapon, 5 related to knives, 3 related to guns, and 6 other weapons. And for conviction of wounding or injuring, 1 related to knives. And then, Mr. Speaker, for policing year 2021, Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid I don't have the breakdown, but I think that it's 2 related to knives, and I don't know how many for other weapons, but I think it's 1 for the further information that I have, because I have a file.
Question number 49, the Honourable D.A. Simpson. Mr. Speaker, how many inmates are thematically treated with the subject of A, mandatory drug testing, and B, voluntary drug testing in the last 3 years? Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
All drug testing currently undertaken at prisons is voluntary, and in the last 3 years, 149 inmates have been tested.
This is the topic that we discussed in the past. I asked questions about this, and something that was included was answered at the time. And just to tell you, Mr. Speaker, to the House and listeners understand this, we introduced a new one that was related to drug testing, and that used to be about 2,000 tests. And my understanding of the answer that was given by the conclusion when I asked this question was that they felt that that they didn't have the resources or the wherewithal to basically undertake and go through a drug testing, but that has been sorted out. And that was about 4 years ago that he provided me with that answer. Now, why is it that there hasn't been any mandatory drug testing, despite the fact that I was told in this house that this was something that could now be performed in the light of changes that have taken place in the security of the country?
The mandatory drug testing is something that has been introduced as a matter of principle, but in terms of operations, because the mandatory drug testing of any kind requires testing at a specific lab that is approved by the Home Office, and this lab is in the UK. And that my understanding is that a lot of sort of the progress that was necessary for this to be implemented last year was slowed down due to COVID. But I'm sure that now at this stage we're able to take that up again. The question
I'm very grateful that the Honourable Lady will look at this further, because the reality of this is that legislative underpinnings in the local draft system was introduced 10 years ago. And the New Zealand local draft system, and even though I think, and I don't necessarily blame the Honourable Lady, because she has inherited the portfolio from others. But obviously she's responsible for the government as a whole. I don't think that the answer with respect to her stacks up. Because the same answer that the Honourable Lady has provided me as to why it hasn't happened was the answer that the city would have provided. That was some time ago that was provided. But she also expressed optimism for this house that it was all now goes to the wind that this is going to happen imminently. Can she at least give this house an undertaking and a story that this year at least all the issues that need to be sorted out will be sorted out so that we can, at long last, have mandatory job systems, so I understand it. It is government policy, obviously, they see the benefits in mandatory drug testing so that we can more effectively deal with drug applications.
Yes, in the context of a relatively new policy of justice, given that for the matter of things that we've been able to deal with in the last year has been COVID-related, and we have an also an even more superintendent of prison, which I've already spoken to the superintendent of prison on this matter, and we have agreed that we are going to move to this into this space.
Next question. Question number 50, the Honourable Chair of the Parliament.
Of the 37,478 total doses of COVID-19 vaccine administered to the NPC 2021, how many of those were to residents and how many to cross-frontier workers?
I'll put the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 51.
Question number 51, the Honourable Chair of the Body.
Of the 32,054 second doses of the COVID-19 vaccine administered on 29th April 2021, how many of those were to residents and how many to cross-frontier workers?
I'll to the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, of those first doses administered, 28,630 were to residents and 8,848 were to non-resident cross-frontier workers. Of those second doses of the vaccine administered, 27,052 were to residents and 5,002 were to non-resident cross-country
residents. Mr. Speaker, does this stat also include the odd cases that have been reported in the press of people who are not quite fit into the category of residents or cross-country workers? And I think we saw my apologies mentioning to me people who don't ride on the yacht have been vaccinated or something. Is that not true? Is the AI see the Honourable and who spoke to the head of the report there was a report? I think, right. And can I ask on the... Did I ask this question on the date of the deadline of the filing of the question? Since the 29th of April, can perhaps the update, does he have an update with her on the situation as of today of the residents and cross-frontier workers, not in terms of first dose, but more interested in the second dose?
Mr. Speaker, the vaccine has been provided to us by the UK government on the basis of those strict criteria and solely being made available to residents. or is there an indication then they're going to cross country registry with no question? But then you're going to arrive and you're going to work to see what actually then do with it. Is that maybe two different recollections? What I read in some reports is that someone who was going to work was complaining because they'd asked for the vaccine and the vaccine was refused. And that is the only circumstance that I'm aware of. I don't know what situation the honourable gentleman is referring to, but I would check it if the honourable gentleman gives me more information. But it's very unlikely on the basis that if people are not resident or not fit into the classification of the question to work for them, then they're not entitled to ask them. Yes, Mr. Speaker, I have the latest statistics I have relate to the 18th of May. And Mr. Speaker, did the other gentleman ask me about second doses for frontier workers? Then, in that case, the total is 8,330.
And for residents, is it?
Same speaker, for residents, second doses is 27,940.
So, am I right to say that, because I'm also noticed that the GSP has made a sort of final for the people to come through and get into the system, etc., that it's still an ongoing process to get through. But we are, would it be fair to say that we are close to the ceiling, that there are ceilings around 28,630, which is the first basis, or is it a higher ceiling?
As you see, the predominantly what the DHA is undertaking at the moment is the second doses, because it's the second doses of the first doses that were administered when we closed the deadline. So we closed the deadline, then we had, this is a program that has been complex. Again, you know, I try to understand it, but it's very scientific in the way that they prepare it, and it's very, very sort of organized in Italy. The second doses are within 21 days of the first dose. But that doesn't mean that the first dose was administered immediately after we closed the deadline. It may well have been administered two or even 3 weeks after, because at that point when we did the deadline, we were still probably administering second doses of people who were with at the time. So it's now very much a question of second doses, but some people have called in, and if a first dose is available because the program allows it to, then exceptions are made for as long as people comply with the requirements.
And can you help with, does he have a figure, does the person have a figure of the people with personal interest, or the registered within the online form, but they're currently conducting, because, for example, they're not here students, that kind of thing. What is the kind of number that we're talking about of people who have not yet had, even though they've expressed an interest, for whatever reason, are in a program for possible vaccination that has still not started?
Because the only group of people who are entitled to a vaccine who have vaccine reserved for them are students. And I know that there is a number reserved for students, and we have students on a waiting list, specifically for students who are not able to take the vaccine because they're not here, but I don't know the number, but I can find the number out and tell you what it is from another day.
The final question on that. In terms of what the minister says, they've got vaccines reserved for students, because students will be coming back maybe in late May, maybe in June, and so on, and given the short life of the vaccine and so on and so forth, when she talks about reservation, does she mean stopping the water? Does she mean that there's a sort of small request for maybe 200 or 300 vaccines that, you know, can be shipped over?
This is actually both, because all students who are in the UK have been asked to register. So on the basis that we know from the students who've registered, it is part of the registration process after that, when they return to Gibraltar. So on that basis, if we can if the 21-day period for the first and the second vaccine is available within the expiry date on the vaccine numbers back from the British side. Here we have that this is a test.
Thank you.
There's an issue in not following up a Facebook person. They do it all the time. You know, whenever you tag a minister, you get success. And it doesn't get a reply. The issue is not whether you're sending a letter or a letter to the Chronicle or talking to somebody. The issue is whether or not investigate whether it's in the context of the fact that the government appears to be intending the view that no person who has wanted to see a dying relative has been unable to, if people are contending that is the case, it's really worthy of investigation to see whether that's correct.
I know that the Honourable Gentleman has not left with many followers and social media feed. I think he might think that it is relatively manageable to deal with issues on social media. But he should know that it is not correct by any stretch of the imagination for him to have got up and held the House, and that is no way to reflect on whether he wishes to correct the record, that when ministers are found on social media, they respond to their issues. But that is not true. The government should know that first of all, there are ministers who are not in social media. Everybody should know that on occasion, sometimes ministers who are tagged in social media may respond to social media. Some ministers may respond on some occasions to social media. But that is not to say that on every occasion, a minister who is tagged is irritated. And said, Mr. Speaker, I would like to know that we are not monitoring social media. We are not monitoring social media. I want to say the contrary, suggesting that we are spending money monitoring social media. When we try whether we are not, then the issue becomes that it's the safety that we're not monitoring social media. For the figure, I entirely agree that if there were instances of individuals who are not vaccinated, who have been prevented from seeing dying relatives, that would be extraordinarily serious. Because the DHA has a mechanism in place to provide for those individuals. But, Mr. Speaker, I think the Honourable Gentleman will agree with me that actually, if we have not received actual complaints about that, then it's very likely that it will happen. It may be that somebody may have feared it would happen, but then subsequently it hasn't happened. Because, as a very Honourable Gentleman, to forget social media, when you're treating it in Gibraltar, when you're Minister for Health in Gibraltar, in traditional media, in other words, in letters, or what you might call emails, now almost traditional media, you will immediately get an issue. Less serious than this is somebody that needs to be brought to attention. Nobody is listening to me to say, I can't even need to follow my family. Your government's policies have prevented me from seeing my loved one from passing away. So, Mr. Speaker, given what we have now told the House, and given the public statements that the Honourable Gentleman has issued, the question really is not whether the government has received these complaints or these issues, because the Honourable Gentleman has clarified. The question is whether the Honourable Gentleman's public statements, all of them so vehement in their defence of this alleged eventuality, which we do not believe has actually occurred, are based on facts or in him just believing what he is on social media.
Next question. Question number 53, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan-Nam.
What was government's ultimate intention when it subsidised 10 students to undertake a social work degree?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the government's intention when it set up the BA Honours in Social Work was to offer the opportunity for a social work degree to be undertaken locally. Mr. Speaker, from what I understand, the government
the government subsidized 10 students at £500 per month times 2.5 years, equaling an investment of £15,000 per student and a total of £150,000 in the total amount of what it costs for these 10 students to get a degree, where they were given expectations of jobs in the end, and part of the contract of the bursary was that they would have to accept jobs locally when available. So my question is, after £750,000 on 10 students, does the government consider this to have been value for money when, from what I understand now, there are 2 to 3 vacancies? How has this cohort profited from this degree, and how has government able to justify this investment into the degree for these 10 students? Mr. Speaker, I will start with the second point first, and that is the point of expectation of a job in the government for some contribution of a degree that is funded by the government, and has gone through all the facilities that were issued at the relevant time, as well as the hindsight of budget features. And there is no single expectation of a job in the government after the completion of a degree in any of those. What it says in that, in all the press releases, is that it is offered individuals interested in under, and I'm going to quote from the press release, social workers are highly rewarding and highly demanding profession that attracts a fairly small number of school leaders. It is a profession that commonly attracts more mature individuals. Locally, many individuals interested in undertaking a profession are highly difficult to reduce their commitment and devoted to that purpose, studying abroad. And all it says after graduation is the only reference in the press release is after graduating, students will become eligible to apply to the ACPC for registration, and then they can apply to work as qualified social workers. If I'm sure that the honourable lady is aware that the government subsidises and funds a labour grant, fortunately, 1,000 students in university and no job in the public sector is guaranteed at the end of any enrolled. When he refers to the bursary and the clothes in the bursary, it will be the same for as anybody who's gone to university, which says that if the government needs to call upon the services of some graduation, then the government, for having funded the studies, the taxpayer can be entitled to them. That was certainly a clause when I received my grant when I went to the university a long time ago, Mr. Speaker. But one thing is, for the government to have organized this training and the offer of this degree locally, and another is that there is an expectation that every single person who graduates from this degree is then going to be employed by the government. Because that is not an expectation that is given to absolutely anyone who undertakes the degree. This is something I regret that the one of the major takes that degree. Mr. Speaker, that was my understanding from the conversations with students who now are hoping that they might get jobs, and the minister perhaps give us any visibility as to whether in the near future or midterm future there might be vacancies coming up for these graduates. Mr. Speaker, yes, of course. And as and when vacancies in the complement of social services arise, then it will be open to a competitive person. So there are 9 or 10 graduates and we have 3 vacancies, then the recruitment will be for 3 people because we have to live within our means and we have to take care of budget. And it will become a competitive process and the best 3 will be selected. So this works exactly the same way as when teachers go off to university and study. And teachers will then apply for the vacancies that arise. Certainly, it is the intention and the long-term intention that the more local social workers we have in social services, the better. That was the rationale for the setting up a degree and the opportunity to do it locally. But that is not the same to say that everyone who graduates at the end of the year will be employed by social services. You can't employ them if you don't have 10 vacancies.
Next question. Question number 54, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Adanon.
Can the Minister just give this House an update on where it is, well, where it is at with regards, one, the Dementia Strategy Committee, two, the Dementia Coordinator, three, the Dementia Liaison Manager.
I for the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
I will
answer the question to the number 55 and 56. Question number 55, the Honourable Ms. Andrea
Hassan. What is government doing to raise awareness on dementia, how to recognise it and eliminate any associated stigma?
Question number 56, the Honourable Ms. Andrea Hassan.
What is government doing to raise the profile of dementia and encourage in the community, organisations and businesses to be dementia-friendly and become a dementia-friendly community?
I for the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, now as we restore, restart and recover, we will revert to all strategic development as soon as possible. Regrettably, Mr. Speaker, we have not been able to advance the dementia strategy over the last year as much as we would have liked to, as the whole of Gibraltar is aware, all which retail resources this year have been diverted to dealing with the pandemic and saving lives. I think it is important to note, however, Mr. Speaker, that all those living with dementia were in no way forgotten about during the pandemic and were supported with increased domiciliary care and a community dementia outreach clinic, providing both better treatment, clinical care, and resilience. Only in July last summer was I told by the previous Minister for Health that the committee, the liaison manager and the coordinator, we, I quote, we are expecting that this will happen sometime within the last quarter of the year. This is back in July, and obviously we didn't have another outbreak of COVID really till Christmas. So considering that the minister says that elderly people with dementia are prioritized and were prioritized, wouldn't the best priority have been to actually fulfill the commitment made by the previous Minister for Health? Because the commitment is there, and have you ever seen it? Because one of the lady in the poll that when we were at our work was in the last quarter of last year, and where the highest number of deaths that we had in Toronto was in December and in January. It all started earlier on in the last quarter of the year. And because there is nothing that I would have loved more than when in August, when I'm at the end of August, when I was disappointed as Minister for Health, to have done everything that we could do when it came to the dementia strategy. It is the strategy of the speaker and the dementia vision is something that I started at the very beginning. Back in 2013, when I was Minister with responsibility for elderly residential services, and for me, it's been extremely satisfactory to see the previous ministers for health and how they have developed it and launched it, as it was launched by the Minister for Health. And there is nothing more than I would have loved to have done in the last quarter of last year, which has developed further the dementia strategy and to be actively dealing with the COVID pandemic. Let's not forget what was happening at the end of last year. Our resources and our full focus and our priority was there for saving lives. And now, Mr. Speaker, that we're coming out of the pandemic and we're starting to restart everything else. Now, let's go back to the strategic work that we've unfortunately had to put in place. Mr. Speaker, every single member of our community in Gibraltar knows that they have an absolute commitment to further and to develop all resources related to dementia from this government, and I'm sure it enjoys the support of everyone in this house. So can one of the ladies give us a new timeline or a new deadline as to when she can commit to this dementia strategy committee coordinator and liaison manager, and also some visibility as to how she's going to fulfill the strategy to make Gibraltar a dementia community, dementia friendly community, some visibility over the plan, please. Because as soon as I can make the announcement, as well as the board level strategic development, I will. And the sooner the
special to the speaker. It's something that I cannot wait to do.
Next question. Question number 67, the honorable may take it in as I know.
Is government in the process of replacing key workers across various health and care centers?
I think the honorable minister for health and justice.
Mr. Speaker, government has various ongoing training programs. Trainings and placement opportunities for the health and care sector. After that training, and offer the opportunity to apply to work across the health and care sector when the opportunities arise. Mr. Speaker, the reason why I ask this question is because there's a lot of insecurity, especially from parents of children with special needs who are feeling a little threatened by what they're hearing. Like some workers who have spent a lot of time and staff with their children are going to be removed in favor of locals who are perhaps on the unemployment list and do not have the same skills or have not spent the same amount of time forming those bonds with the residents or the students and children. And I would like to understand from the Minister if the parents have reason to be concerned and to prepare themselves for some change in key workers, or if the ones who have long-standing carers whose children or young adults are very much connected to the less secure that these workers will not be removed from their children. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, in the case of where it is relevant, this process has been discussed at length with family members by those in the polls. Mr. Speaker, it is the policy of the government where a vacancy in a service arises, that vacancy can be filled by someone who is a resident and with whom we have invested local trade. This is very much a program, Mr. Speaker, that we have embarked on with the agreement of the union, because, Mr. Speaker, the long-term plan is that this is what is going to give the service users of the facilities that continuity long-term, Mr. Speaker. What we've one of the things that has resulted from has been brought into great focus during a combination of last year dealing with COVID and dealing with Brexit is over reliance on essential workers, Mr. Speaker. And therefore it is absolutely important and essential that we invest in people who are resident in the world that could give us that continuity and to minimize that risk, Mr. Speaker. Now, because continuity is so important for these individuals, Mr. Speaker, the relationship with the people has already been established, and after it is a placement is undertaken and the institution is part of the training, so that relationship starts there. But after the training, then there will be a period of studies so that the individual already has a relationship with the person who is coming. Mr. Speaker, I consider the Minister's answer quite concerning for the families of children and young adults who are very much connected to their carers. And when he talks about continuity long term, I think the best continuity one could give these children and young adults is to be around the very people who they trust and have been with. That is continuity, Mr. Speaker. But on the question of over reliance, I'd like to ask how the Minister can marry the prospects that we understand in here from government about shared or Schengen area into the future where there won't be any divisions and less borders, for lack of a better word. Yet we're looking to rely less on the very neighboring area that we're supposed to be so connected to post-Brexit with this new prospect of Schengen possibility.
ground across the floor of the house with respect to how nation people have a bad thing and we can't start the negotiation by putting ourselves in a situation and in any aspect of our economy, the health and care sector or otherwise, where we become more dependent as we go into the negotiation which might not be fruitful, but than we were before the negotiation completed. And I agree with the statement of speaker, based on the new regime agreement, is there going to be a 4-year period of bedding in, at the end of which choices may have to be made, and a position will have to be taken by the government of Georgia as it is to the museum. I hope that we will be returned at the next election, we will be there again. I'm sure that we will only continue the present arrangement, continue, and not a new arrangement coming, we will be foolish to put ourselves in a situation of further dependence now. But speaker, the honourable lady, I think, needs to understand that these are not indefinite contracts that are being extended. These were always contracts for a fixed term. And when those contracts started, there was no relationship between the individual being cared for and the individual providing the care. And now, Mr. Speaker, perhaps there will be a change, but it depends on the property managed for people who are properly qualified and to people who are from the Gibraltar, and who are therefore more likely to eventually stay in those jobs, whatever happens in relation to the treaty. So, Mr. Speaker, I have seen here before in this situation, in relation to other individuals, where we have been asked by members of the government, time that we have been in government, why these changes are happening, and we said because we're training to Gibraltarians and we're putting to Gibraltarians in jobs, which is our stated policy position, to find long-term jobs for Gibraltarians. And of course, it continues to be an engine for the economy all around us, but in this area to provide jobs for Gibraltarians, long-term jobs for Gibraltarians. And actually, subsequently, those Gibraltarians have built those relationships with the people that they care for, and they have continued. But we also have to understand, Mr. Speaker, that in the context of these relationships, the Honourable Lady and I have been discussing with the unions on a number of occasions, the commitment that is being sought is one-sided. In other words, what is being thought is that the government says, I will never change the carer because the carer has built a relationship with the person being cared for. There's nothing to stop the carer, and it's happened on many occasions to say, I can't get a job, I'm going. My family circumstances have changed, and I'm going to leave, or I seek a promotion. So we have to understand that in that context, and we say these things as a speaker with the greatest sensitivity, because we do understand that the relationships between those who require care and those who provide care are sometimes as close as family relationships. I've experienced that with a relative in care, and the bond that is created between those who are caring for our loved ones, who need that care, is sometimes a thing that must be unfriendly. But we have a responsibility to manage the job market, to do so sensitively, and to create those in the same relationships in a way that will have the longevity that our sometimes precarious political situation requires us to give them, and in a way that ensures that we're also creating local, worthy, long term employment in the future.
Next question. Question number 68, your work is MD as I know.
Can the Minister of Health confirm if there are 70 any colorectal specialists working out of the GHA?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, if the question is meant to ask if there are any colorectal specialists working in the GHA, then the answer is yes. That was the question, and if the Minister tells you yes, I would like more detail on who the specialist is, because I have three cases of constituents who have been told that they haven't been specialists since back in January, and have been delayed in their care for 4 months, leading them to have to go to the UK, because simply they're told to just go home because there is no specialist that can see them. So perhaps if you can point me to that colorectal specialist, I can tell my constituents who they have to go to because at the GHA they've been told to wait because there is an end. So, Mr. Speaker, I am very surprised to hear that, and I would invite the other ladies to continue. In fact, it's a solution to us, but if you feel something like that, it's a strange in relation to the GHA, and please Mr. Speaker, there was a changeover in relation to doctors, and a locum was engaged, and it may have been that there was a window between one doctor being absent and the locum being reported, which I can very much confirm that there is a doctor in place as the user. I thank us for that answer, and I'm sure you know that obviously I always try to go to her first degree when it would help more than anything. There's no time to make any political points, but unfortunately, I've learned to this after the situation has unfolded and after they've had to go to the UK. So my question was genuinely generic. Do we have a specialist? Can I just ask her perhaps later to explain to me behind the speaker's chair who these specialists are, and whether I can also ask her now whether the clinic has embarked on a general colorectal screening program for patients. Mr. Speaker, there has always been a colorectal screening program for patients, but there is no mystery in the consultant and not the consultant. If an individual cannot be referred to a consultant by myself or by the other lady, so an individual needs to be referred to by a speaker.
Next question. Question number 59. The order is ending at 1 hour.
To whom was the contract for the rapid testing station outside the Gibraltar Airport awarded, and how did the government come to award this contract to said person entity?
I for the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, this contract was awarded to Maritime Medical Services Limited as a result of a competitive tendering process. Mr. Speaker, there are some individuals who have approached me telling me that there was not a competitive tender process, and I put my hand up here. This is why I'm asking the question in good faith, as to whether there was one. So I would appreciate it perhaps if the Minister could give me a little bit more detail of when now that tender took place so that I can inform these individuals who insist that there was no tender at all and it was directly allocated. As you see that, there is absolutely no question of it being directly allocated to anyone. The tender invitation for tender for the contract went out on the 22nd of October 2020. And there were various entities who tendered. So even if you have a lady, I don't want to take my word for it, then you can ask the other people who tendered for it, who will then confirm that there was a tender process. One organization was successful, other companies were not successful, but they all tendered before the final result.
After that final question by the Honourable Lady, and I move that the House is now adjourned to tomorrow at 3 p.m. in the afternoon to continue the discussion. I now propose the question that this House is now adjourned to Thursday, the 20th of May at 3 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House is now adjourned to Thursday, the 20th of May at 3 p.m. Those in favor, those against, pass. This House will now adjourn to Thursday, the 20th of May at 3 p.m.